From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with actor Edward James Olmos. He plays the hard-as-granite Lieutenant Castillo on the TV series Miami Vice. He also stars in the upcoming film Stand and Deliver. Also today, a lesson in wine tasting from Robert Parker, one of the most influential wine critics in the world. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of composer Witold Lutosławski conducting his own works. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg has some more observations on sexism in language. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Edward James Olmos doesn't speak much in his role as Lieutenant Castillo on Miami Vice. Castillo keeps his emotions to himself, but he's a strong-willed man who knows how to get the job done.
I will bust anyone necessary.
You won't hear that mumbly deadpan in Olmos' new film, Stand and Deliver. It's based on the true story of a teacher in an inner-city high school in East Los Angeles. The students are doing so poorly, the school is about to lose its accreditation, until a new Hispanic math teacher, played by Olmos, arrives on the scene. He's so fired up about the importance of education for his Hispanic students, he's able to teach them calculus. And he does it by provoking them verbally, joking, encouraging, and when necessary, taunting a student who shows up late or neglects his homework. Here he is throwing one latecomer out of the class, telling him to forget math and consider maybe cosmetology.
The counselor was just here looking for you. Something about some cosmetology classes. He says there's three different levels. One for boys, one for girls, and one for I don't know what kind. Why don't you go find out?
Okay, well, please listen, man. It's cool. My grandmother.
Clock out. Game's over. You lose.
You never listen to nobody, man.
Adios. Why don't you send me some postcards? Or call me on the telephone. Let me know how you're doing. We love you.
That's Lou Diamond Phillips as the student kicking over a desk on the way out of class. Both Phillips and Olmos got their start with writer and director Luis Valdez in La Bamba for Phillips and Zoot Suit for Olmos. Olmos also starred in The Ballad of Gregorio Cortez and was featured in Blade Runner and Wolfen. Olmos has turned down several roles during his career. I asked him what he liked about his role in Stand and Deliver.
Basically, it was the story. I've only turned down things really because of the story, the concept. I'm really not as accomplished an actor as maybe some other people. They can just take anything. I really have to understand the story and really have a strong passion for it. And that's what happened with this one. When I read it, I just came out of my seat. I found it to be the most extraordinary, just extraordinary story I'd ever read.
What did you relate to about the teacher?
Well, it wasn't the teacher so much. It was more of the motivational aspect of the story. What exactly, this is like a Rocky or a Karate Kid or one of those kind of uplifting human endeavors that is coming at us at the most unusual place I've ever thought of, and that's in the schoolroom. And it happens that, the story, as people will find out, I won't give away too much, but you'll find out these kids, normal average kids, are taken on a real, real whirlwind acceptance of that they can accomplish things that they really want to.
You know, I think a lot of your fans from Miami Vice won't recognize you in this new movie. You play a teacher who's balding, paunchy, stooped, very square in a lot of ways, and very physically vulnerable. Did you have to learn a different kind of posture, a different way of carrying your body?
Yeah, there was. I got a opportunity to do something that I'd never been able to do before. Actors, say like Meryl Streep and De Niro, Hoffman, Pacino, they get an opportunity to concentrate on a role for say about a year and a half, maybe 2 years, and then they go ahead and they portray it. most actors, myself included, we're lucky if we get a week advance notice that we're going to do a part. You know, you go to a casting call and you end up getting the opportunity to do it. In this case, I was given the opportunity to start research on this man approximately about 2 years beforehand. So I had a good study period time in order which to really become familiar with him. And I took that opportunity to not only understand his insides, but to understand his outsides. And basically people have said, now, why did you have to look like him? Because basically, you know, nobody knows what he looks like anyway, so you could have just turned around and just did it. But I think that his physicalness has a lot to do with him in the same way that you would say the robust look of Santa Claus, you know, has a lot to do with him. There's no way that you could see Santa Claus being 6'1", weighing 160 pounds, bench pressing 230. He would be a funny-looking guy.
You actually gained a lot of weight for this movie, didn't you?
Yeah, I went from 157 to, at the last 3 weeks into the shoot, I was weighing in at 200 pounds. About 198 to 200 pounds. It all depends if I drank a glass of water or not.
Did you lose it afterwards?
I'm down. I have 12 more pounds to go to get back to 157. It's been the hardest. I'm 41 years old. It's been the hardest thing I've tried to do. I can understand why people really find it difficult. The first 10 pounds came off real easy. After that, I found myself losing weight, but I was really not losing the fat. I was losing muscle tone. And I began to work out extensively, and I've been doing that ever since, just trying to keep my muscle tone while the fat tissue just burns off. It's very, very difficult. I take my hat off to people who have taken off weight and kept it off, because it's a very hard, hard procedure.
It's interesting, you're this paunchy guy in the movie, and you rest your hands on your stomach a lot as you're walking, which I think is very kind of typical gesture for someone who has a paunch, and something you probably had to learn, having never had one before.
Yeah, all the behavior that I do on the film, I must tell you, I've been doing this for over 20 years, and I must tell you that I've done, I think, probably one of the most concise performances and the most disciplined performances I've ever done in my life, but it doesn't even come close to the kind of charisma that this man really has. It's a mirror image of the person, and I did something that usually breaks the cardinal rule never to do, and that's to perform the person while the person is in your presence. And, you know, I had him on the set every day, and I worked with him on the set while I was working on the picture, and felt a tremendous sense of commitment on his part, and ended up doing what I consider to be one of the truest performances I've ever given.
My guest is Edward James Olmos, who's best known for his role in Miami Vice as Lieutenant Castillo, and he stars as a teacher in the new movie Stand and Deliver, which is about to open. I'd like to ask you a few things about your role in Miami Vice. Did you work on the character yourself when you accepted the role in the series? Did you work with the writers to develop the character?
In actuality, I got the role on a Wednesday, Thursday morning at 7 o'clock. I was in front of the cameras portraying him. So they really didn't know the character at all. The writers didn't, and they had already started to write for the character. I was given the... Michael Mann was kind enough to invite me to join the group, but he also allowed me the freedom of artistic control of the character. So I ended up developing the character on the plane right over, and henceforth, every day that I'd try to play catch-up with the character, and I would concentrate on developing the character. For the first 3 years, it was really a sense of... developing the character and letting him ride. This year has been the most fun using the character. I've had a strong part in a lot of the shows this year, so we've been having a lot of fun with him. But I did develop the character, and the writers were very surprised when I started crafting the character. The directors would come to direct us at the beginning, and they didn't quite know what I was doing, and the editors didn't know what I was doing, and they would only switch to me when I would talk, and I never talked.
That's right.
And I kept on taking words out and taking dialogue out, and I would take myself out of scenes and people were getting very, very suspicious of.
Well,
my
why would an actor take himself out of a scene?
Well, he didn't belong there. Basically, it was to put an actor or to put a character in the scene just to put the character in there to sell the television show. It's a mistake. You put the person in the scene because it's part of the scene. It has to make the scene work.
Was it your idea to have the character so held in, have all the emotions and everything so held in? The character's always simmering but never boils over.
Yeah, it was basically my intent to portray him that way. That's the kind of police officers that I found to be most exciting. I still find this character to be one of the most exciting characters I've ever portrayed.
It must be sometimes frustrating for you because just having seen you in Stand and Deliver and in Zoot Suit, you really have a gift for being very, very verbally colorful in movies. And in this, you're so restrained, you're so locked in all the time, so nonverbal. Don't you ever want to kind of cut loose?
Well, I think if there was an opportunity for... See, Castillo does cut loose, but they've never given him the opportunity to show them how he cuts loose, and they've never really... See, the show is geared around a certain formula, the formula being that we're really doing a character study of two individuals, similar to the I Spy formula that they use in Format that they used, and or Starsky and Hutch, or any duo team, Simon and Simon. This was never intended to be an ensemble piece, and my character was never intended to draw the attention that it has to itself. I think that they were very surprised, and I was too, that the character would have such a resounding effect on the viewers. And the cry has come from all over the world that they would like to know more about the character and would like to see him take a larger part in the stories.
Hey, maybe a spin-off series, huh?
Well, I think that they maybe have been contemplating. I have not been approached in any way whatsoever, but I would love to portray this character outside of this show.
I read somewhere, I think it was in Harper's Magazine or something, that the budget of an episode of Miami Vice is usually more than the annual budget for the Miami Vice squad. Is that about right?
I would have to say probably is.
What's the police reaction to that?
Same thing that the reaction is of the Teachers of America and the Nurses of America and all the people who really work very, very hard and diligently with the humanities in the humanities. Police officers, teachers, really underpaid, overworked, not appreciated enough. And here you have a craft that is... burns money excessively and extensively. It's out of control. It's like the government, you know, it's out of control also. They burn money worse than any film could ever burn money.
When Miami Vice started out, the three main leads weren't really well known to the American public. And then as the series became very popular, Don Johnson suddenly became this really big sex symbol across America. When he became this big star, did it affect the dynamics on the set? Because stars will sometimes be very, very demanding, and suddenly they really need to be catered to. I don't know. Did you ever feel like you had to put him in his place or anything?
Basically, Don has been very respectful to me and to my character. He didn't like my character at the beginning. He didn't like the choices that I was making. They were a little bit hard to deal with, and I could understand it. I had him knock on the door the very first time he came into the room, and he really didn't want that kind of behavior between the crew, meaning, you know, that this was supposed to be a group of individuals that were really liked each other, and they were all a big family. And I said to him, it's wonderful if I had started off with a family, but we actually have an entrance with where I am brought into the picture as a brand new time walking in the door. So I think we have to build a certain amount of understanding that we are not good friends, and you know, we'll have to learn to respect each other as time goes on, if that's the way it's going to be. But he had a hard time with my character at the beginning. You could feel the tension, and it actually helped the show. In real life, I've known Don since about 1968, when I saw him do Fortune in Men's Eyes with Sal Mineo over at the Coronet Theater in Los Angeles. And I always say that he hasn't really changed one bit since the day I met him. He just has reason to feel, you know, the way he does now.
Okay. Well,
if you understand that one.
I don't really. What do you mean by that? Oh, I understand. No. Let me paraphrase that. He used to have a really big ego, and now he has good reason to have a big ego because he's famous. Okay, I got it.
Okay. He's always been very good looking, and he's always had a tremendous sense of self-worth, and he's always been on the cusp of breaking loose. I don't know if you ever saw the boy, you know, Boy and His Dog, or the Herod Experiment, or
no. But I saw him in a small part in an episode of Kung Fu.
Yeah. Well, he did the whole. He was his own worst enemy for many, many years. Philip, I've known since 1971, which I did a film with him then, and Philip has always stayed consistent with his universe.
Okay, well, my guest is Edward James Olmos, who co-stars in Miami Vice as Lieutenant Castillo and is starring in a new film called Stand and Deliver, which is about to open. We're going to talk more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Actor Edward James Olmos is my guest. Now, if I understand correctly, you had actually turned down a role on Hill Street Blues, and also turned down a role in Scarface, perhaps the leading role.
I had turned down quite a few stories that had come to me. The reason I turned down the Hill Street Blues situation was for the same reason that I had turned down Miami Vice the first 5 times they called me. I really have been working for a long time on different projects that are maybe not as resounding as commercially as other stories that have been offered to me, but they were stories that I really believed in. And I really could not, and I still do not, have the capability of seeing myself sign a contract for 7 years with a network and a film company. So I told Stephen Bochco when he would call me that I really, really appreciated and I really adored that program. I think that that's one of the truly great programs that have revolutionized television. That I couldn't partake in Hill Street Blues because of the fact that I could not sign an exclusive contract with him. And he understood. And, you know, every year he'd call me to see if I had changed my mind. And I would, for the first 3 years, I was very, very happy. By the fourth year, they didn't call me anymore. But that fourth year, Vice called me, and they offered me a very lucrative job that I had more money than I'd ever made in my life, and very good, you know, consistent work, and I had to tell them no. It was a very hard decision, but I just couldn't see myself signing a 7-year contract.
Have you ever turned down a role because you thought it was an ethnically stereotyped role?
Basically, I've just turned down roles because I didn't understand the story or I didn't think that I could be a part of that story. That's the only thing that I really deal with, and that's the story and whether or not I can find myself inside the story. Now, within that, the context of those values, there might be times when there'll be, you know, individuals they'll be wanting me to play that I wouldn't play even if the story was correctly. But basically, I always go for story, and story has been the thing that has knocked me out. Of taking Scarface or Firestarter or Band of the Hand. They wanted me to lead quite a few of those pictures. I just couldn't see myself doing it. So therefore, I mean, I really had no passion or commitment to really getting involved other than for the money. And I've lived real modestly with my family for a long, long time, and we continue to do that. And it's easier to not be owned by your possessions, so you end up... you know, being able to say no.
Can I ask you a few things about when you were younger? You grew up in East Los Angeles, and I know that your father was Mexican, and when he moved to America, he didn't speak English. Were you very anxious to fully assimilate and to not be you know, connected to a foreign language or another country the way a lot of people are who have parents who are immigrants?
I actually, when I was being raised in the area which I was raised in, it was like the Ellis Island of the West Coast. And it was a community that was filled with Russian immigrants, black, Native American, Hispanic, Asian. You had a cross-cultural situation that I thought was the norm for the rest of the country and around the world. I thought that everywhere was just a mixture of a whole bunch of different kind of people. So my community was one that probably indicated more of what's going to come in the future, but was a little bit ahead of its time, and I felt really fortunate to come from there because I didn't build the prejudices that a lot of people in an isolated community would do, whether it be brown, black, yellow, red, or white. You know, when you're all in one environment, you don't really have an opportunity to understand the joys of the differences, and you end up making differences be a negative rather than a positive.
Your first big break in acting was in Zoot Suit. You played El Pachuco. I'm going to ask you to very briefly describe the role and to tell me what you really related to about the play and about the role that you played.
The part, what it ended up being was the first time that I performed in a piece that was actually heard, you know, critically acclaimed across the country and around the world. It was a character that was indigenous to the Southwest, and it was a cross between Mexican and American. It was an American phenomena, really. He was they're called Pachucos, and I played El Pachuco in the play Zoot Suit, and it was really a character study of the construct of a new culture that was starting to materialize in the 20s and 30s and really came to full force in the 40s. And the story takes place in 1940 when 13 kids were actually accused of the murder of one boy and sentenced to prison. And they were all under the age of 16, except for one who was 18, but they all went to San Quentin. And it was the first mass arrest and trial and conviction that had ever been held in the United States of America. And it took place in 1943. And I play a character that is actually the embodiment of the spirit of what Pachuquismo is all about. And so I was like the Greek chorus, or like, alter ego to the main lead character and to the piece itself.
What did you relate to about that role?
Well, since I am Mexican-American, and I was raised in the area in which a lot of Pachucos lived and really became aware of their manhood, I really could relate to the character an awful lot because I lived with these guys every single day of my life when I was growing up, and it was, you know, they would wear, what a Pachuco really is a streetwise person who could be in any culture, from any culture, but he uses his pride, his self-esteem, his self-respect, good virtues, but he uses them as a shield to protect himself. So he walks around with an attitude, and the attitude has been, you know, brought about by, you know, against fear because of indecisiveness, lack of confidence, and they gain their confidence by walking around with this sense of, you know, self-worth and self-pride that they wear up as a shield, and you really can't really get inside to really know them. They're really wonderful people, but they really don't let anybody see that. They just let the stern, rough, hard edge be seen to protect them. So it's really just a streetwise person that uses his good values as a protective shield against the outside world.
Were you streetwise at all when you were growing up, or is that something that you had to, like, learn as an actor to do for your performances?
No, I was literally born first in Indiana, in the heart of East Los Angeles, and it was wonderful. I mean, again, like I said, I didn't know any difference, so I didn't know we were having a hard time, but it was really great. I mean, we'd run through the alleys and watch the situations of the street materialize and play itself through, and they would range everything from from, you know, everything that happens on the street. Go to New York or go to any big city, and you go to the street, and you're going to find every possible facet of life exploring itself, from the goodness to the badness of it. And, yeah, I was educated on the street, and I really think that that was a tremendous asset to studying human behavior and being able to portray some of the stuff that I've been able to do.
You're living in Miami now so that you can be near where Miami Vice is shot. Have you ever been in a restaurant and had a feeling that there was some kind of drug deal going down in that restaurant, and then the people who are doing the deal notice you and kind of confuse you momentarily with the character that you play? Did anything like that ever happen?
Not to my knowledge. Contrary to popular belief, I mean, there's a lot of transactions that go there. But unless you're into drugs, you really will never see it, nor will you ever really be aware that it's happening. They're very, very tactful about their behavior over there. Basically, I think it's probably one of the nicest places I've ever lived in my life. And I highly think that the place is just a dream for families and for people to live in. Now, if you're dealing in drugs, it could be a nightmare because that place is really rough. But if you're not dealing in drugs, it very seldom do you ever get involved with anything to do with the bad part of it, no more than you would, say, in any other city, and maybe some you would even get more. By being mistaken for a real police officer, I don't think anyone really would mistake me for a real police officer and say, oh, there's Lieutenant Castillo from Miami Vice, and really get... If anything, they'd kind of chuckle and want to invite me over and say hi, you know. But that doesn't really happen.
In your new movie, Stand and Deliver, you co-star with Rosanna DeSoto, who played with you in The Ballad of Gregorio Cortez. Lou Diamond Phillips, who starred in La Bamba, plays one of your students. La Bamba was written by Luis Valdez, who directed you in Zoot Suit. Is there a community of Mexican-American actors who are getting together now and trying to come up with, interesting plays and movies that can feature more Mexican-American actors?
Well, I think that there's a strong community, within our culture, just like in any culture. But there has been an extraordinary amount of interest in the... Hispanic American culture and in the arts, and I think it's because of the amount of people that there are here, and the fact that we have to learn more about them, and two, the fact that it's economically viable now. La Bamba scored over $66 million in theater rentals, and just opened up a whole big market out there for these kind of films. And I think that people are really excited about it, and I really feel that the future for the ethnics in the United States of America, the Anglo being also one of them, it will inevitably grow, and people will... It's moving very slowly, but it is moving. And, I think the community is happening.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thanks for your time.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, Terry.
Thank you. My guest has been actor Edward James Olmos, who's best known for his role in Miami Vice as Lieutenant Castillo. He's starring in a new film called Stand and Deliver, in which he plays a teacher who is able to teach his students calculus in spite of the fact that in the school's about to lose its academic accreditation. Stand and Deliver will open across the country over the next few weeks. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Bernice Johnson Reagan. She's the founder of the women's a cappella singing group Sweet Honey and the Rock, and she's the director of the Black American Culture Project at the Smithsonian Institution, for which she's done research on freedom songs of the civil rights movement. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, it's a tough job, but someone's got to do it. Wine expert Robert Parker samples as many as 200 wines every week. His appraisals of those wines, published in his newsletter and books, have earned him the reputation as one of the world's most influential wine critics. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording that features Witold Lutosławski as both composer and conductor. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg examines some subtle examples of sexism in speech. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Lori Waffen-Schmidt. The South African government today effectively shut down the political activity of most anti-government organizations and placed 18 leading critics under restrictions known as banning orders. NPR's John Madison reports from Johannesburg.
The Anti-Apartheid United Democratic Front, or UDF, and many of its affiliate organizations, which have been at the forefront of anti-apartheid protest for about 5 years, have been banned. They cannot take any political action without government approval. The same restrictions apply to several other organizations, including a human rights group, the Detainees Parents Support Committee. Law and Order Minister Adrian Flock says that 18 anti-apartheid leaders are to have their movements restricted. UDF co-presidents Albertina Sisulu and Archie Gumede have already been placed under house arrest. The organizations affected spent the day consulting with their lawyers. They're expected to challenge the restrictions in court. Archbishop Desmond Tutu says the bans are an unmitigated disaster, which amounts to a declaration of war by the government. I'm John Madison in Johannesburg.
State Department spokesman Charles Redmond today said the U.S. government is appalled by the crackdown in South Africa and has issued a strong protest to Pretoria's ambassador. More from NPR's Ted Clark.
Redmond warned that South Africa's crackdown could lead to greater violence there.
By acting to outlaw the nonviolent political activity of these organizations, the South African government has dealt a severe blow to efforts to achieve a peaceful solution to South Africa's problems. This is a giant step backward for South Africa.
Administration officials seem genuinely stunned by the crackdown. Said one, "We're sort of numbed by the sweeping nature of this development." According to another official, the crackdown seems to mark the end of an era of modest reform in South Africa. Congress had already planned hearings next month on bills to impose stricter sanctions on South Africa. Today's news seems likely to add new energy to that initiative. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
House leaders have put off a vote on a revised contra-aid package originally scheduled for tomorrow. Democrats have crafted a $30 million non-lethal assistance plan as an alternative to an administration request defeated earlier this month. Republicans today said they would not support the new proposal and would come up with one of their own. Democrats have not announced a new date for the contra vote. The East German Foreign Ministry said today that the Soviet Union will begin pulling out nuclear missiles tomorrow from two East German bases. At the same time, the Czechoslovak Communist Party Daily said the Kremlin would start to withdraw missiles from that country in a couple of days. Western diplomats interpret the Soviet move as a gesture of goodwill, but also designed to put pressure on the United States. The Soviets have said they will not destroy the weapons until the Senate ratifies the medium-range missile treaty. Defense Secretary Frank Carlucci today defended his handling of Navy budget cuts. He was responding to criticism by outgoing Navy Secretary James Webb that Carlucci showed bad judgment in deciding to cut 16 frigates from the naval fleet. Webb resigned this week because of his disagreement with Carlucci. Carlucci said today he was not aware of Webb's unhappiness until he quit.
Secretary Webb never came to me with any protests over the budget cuts. Nor was I aware of his letter of his intention to resign until the letter actually landed on my desk.
The Navy's 1989 budget proposal was cut by $12 billion as part of an overall defense reduction of $33 billion. Exports climbed to an all-time highs in the last quarter of 1987. The Commerce Department said the nation's trade deficit declined $200 million from the previous 3 months. The quarterly trade deficit fell to $40.2 billion, the first improvement since last spring. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was fractionally higher, closing at 2039.95. Advances led declines in heavy trading of 212 million shares. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Polish composer Witold Lutosławski recently celebrated his 75th birthday. Today, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz celebrates a new recording of the composer, conducting three of his own works from widely spaced phases of his career.
Lately, I've been overcoming my preconceptions about contemporary Eastern European music, my fear that it's going to batter my eardrums with clangy church and shipyard music or People's Party propaganda. I've been listening to Lutosławski, who turns out to be more interested in beautiful textures and unusual but comprehensible structures. He even has a sense of humor. His recording, Lutosławski Conducts Lutosławski, includes an impressive live performance of his 1970 cello concerto with the brilliant cellist Heinrich Schiff. Another important cellist, Mstislav Rostropovich, who encouraged Lutosławski to write it, thinks it's the greatest cello concerto ever written. I can't think of a major concerto in which the solo instrument is more independent. It seems to be going through a series of adventures, like an argonaut or an astronaut. In its long opening soliloquy, the steady ticking is like a heartbeat, but the outside world insists on intruding. The orchestra is the constantly metamorphosing enemy, a traffic jam of honking brass, a pizzicato rainfall, a jam session with the plucked cello as double bass. These interruptions keep recurring, but the ticking continues as if time itself couldn't stop or be stopped for anything. Lutosławski is probably best known for his use of aleatoric or chance music. At certain places carefully indicated in the score, the notes may be played at whatever speed or tempo each player in the orchestra wishes, but it's more a free fall than a free-for-all. Time, at least the kind of timing you've gotten used to, is temporarily suspended. If the first section of this single movement piece is earth, the second is air. It's filled with eerie textures, swarming birds or insects, or interstellar winds. It also has the cello's most rhapsodic music. The last section is more confrontational and more disjointed. The cello argues with the orchestra. At another point, it seems to be chuckling to itself or sighing, maybe even dying. It reminds me of the death of Don Quixote in Richard Strauss's tone poem. Strauss's hero is also played by a cello. Our hero recovers, but the ending is ambiguous, defiant, yet also resigned. The earliest work on the album dates back to 1955, five very brief dance preludes, delightful folk pieces for solo clarinet and chamber orchestra that pick up where Bartók left off. The album ends with the tricky, ironic double concerto for oboe and harp, completed in 1980 and commissioned by Heinz and Ursula Holliger, its two dazzling soloists. With the composer conducting, there's no questioning the authenticity and authority of these performances.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and teaches at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. He reviewed Lutosławski conducts Lutosławski on the Philips label. This is Fresh Air. Robert Parker would like to see the average American reach for a glass of wine with a meal the way they might reach for a Coke. Parker is considered by many to be one of the world's leading wine critics. His newsletter, The Wine Advocate, has the influence to make or break a vineyard. He's also written three books on his favorite subject. Parker says he started writing about wine to help the consumer choose the best buy for the money. That was 10 years ago. Today, Parker tastes nearly 10,000 different wines a year. I asked him what he looks for in a wine.
A wine that smells like a barnyard or smells like a chemical plant is obviously a bad wine and not terribly enjoyable. I think you're looking, it's like whether you're looking at a work of art or listening to music, you're looking for a certain harmony. And when I say harmony, I'm talking about a balanced impression in the mouth. You don't want the wine to taste tart like you're biting into a lemon. You don't want it to taste real acidic. You don't want it to taste astringent as if someone were rubbing a piece of sandpaper across your tongue. You want to be able to taste something that is velvety and is enjoyable to drink. And if you can't reach that conclusion that's enjoyable, then something's probably wrong with the wine.
I know that there's some days when I just have a kind of funny taste in my mouth that I can't seem to get rid of. For you, that would really be an occupational hazard. What do you do to make sure that your palate is cleared before tasting a wine?
Well, there's no question that if you're going to taste wines, there are certain things that you should avoid. If you've been nibbling on a lot of chocolate bars, chocolate is absolutely, it leaves a residue on your palate that absolutely destroys the taste of both white and red wine. And so, you want to stay away from chocolate. There are other foods. Obviously you wouldn't go to your favorite Cajun restaurant and have a big spicy meal and want to drink a fine wine because wines just don't work with that sort of food. If you'd like to eat a lot of garlic actually doesn't work that well with wine, especially fresh garlic. Vinegar is, of course, one of the taboos if you're going to taste a lot of wine. But I find some of these are overworked. This whole field of wine food matchups has probably been so legislated by the wine press that it actually intimidates people.
How many hours before you taste wine do you brush your teeth?
Well, I get up very early in the morning and I brush my teeth, but I never drink coffee the day that I'm going to be tasting wine. Coffee is another caffeine for me anyhow. I don't know how it affects other people, but for me, leaves a residue and gives the wines a certain sharpness. So I brush my teeth, but one of the things I do and have learned is sort of a trick of the professional wine tasting is I drink an enormous amount of water. And what I find the most refreshing thing for cleaning your palate, so to speak, after you, you know, you taste 20, 25 wines, there's a certain amount of fatigue that sets in. I will drink, have Perrier or some other sort of sparkling water, and I'll taste that, gargle it, spit it out, and I find this tends to revive the palate.
When you're tasting wine, do you actually swallow it, or do you, like some wine tasters do, swish it around your mouth and then spit it out?
And when you're tasting professionally, you obviously can't, particularly when you're tasting the number of wines that I am, you can't possibly swallow the wine. You'd never be,
you'd be totally inebriated.
By mid-morning, if
right.
not earlier. So, I think you have to spit it out. Some people say, gee, I can't really effectively taste the wine unless I swallow it. That's a myth. All you have to do, your tongue is divided into sort of tasting centers, and which pick up, sharpness, softness, sugar, acid, and the impression of depth. Most of the wine evaluation, to be truthful, is really based on smell. But I spit, and what I do is, I sort of take a sip of wine, and by pulling in air over the wine, the wine, all these aromas from the wine sort of oxidize and evaporate and go up into your nasal passages. And then by circulating it around on your palate and then spitting it out, the most important thing of telling the difference between a good and a great wine is that when after you spit it out, or in the case of someone who's drinking, swallowing the wine, is the perception that wine is still in your mouth. Even after there's none there, it's this residue of the wine left on your palate or your tongue. Generally, that's called length or finish. And the great wines, the really outstanding wines, that perception can last 30 seconds, 45 seconds, even 60 seconds. I've even gone to the trouble of sitting watching my watch and saying, gee, can I still sense this wine there?
I'm interested in the language of wine writing. You have to come up with descriptions for every single wine that you taste. I just chose one at random, really. Here's a description of one of the many Bordeaux's in your Bordeaux book. You describe it as a rather loosely knit wine with very good color, jammy, grapey, fruit, low acidity, and a lush, supple texture. This medium to full-bodied wine has a precocious personality and a charming fruitiness and will evolve rapidly. The language of wine is so interesting. It's like you're talking about a person, a precocious personality, a charming fruitiness. Is this like standard language for wine?
Well, I think one of the things that I didn't find attractive when I was reading a lot of wine books is that so much of the language about wine was very stilted, because I think England has long been recognized as the wine writing capital of the world. And the English, used, almost elitist terms and a very floral sort of writing style. And what I tried to do when I started writing was really be direct and simple. Now, you may find that description, quite overly complex or something. But, I tried to, one, say, look, wines do have personalities. And I often, you can compare certain wines to, a plump individual or a reticent or shy individual. And I keep it simple. If I started saying that this wine smells of mahogany or some sort of rare flower, like a lot of winemakers have done for centuries, how many people know what that smells like? Even saying a wine smells like a truffle, how many people actually get a chance to taste a fresh truffle or something? I have used that term because I do sense that in certain wines. But I try and keep it very simple and very straightforward and try and use analogies to behavior characteristics of human beings, because I think wines are living and they're changing and they have personalities and character. And so if you can describe it in that sense, I think it's more meaningful to the reader.
I don't know if you'll agree with this, but it seems to me that in the United States, drinking wine is considered somewhat effete and effeminate. And how men are sometimes mocked for liking white wine? I can't really understand that. What do you think of that?
Well, I think that the general image of wine in the United States, unfortunately, is one of a sort of an elitist beverage. At least the fine wine sector, and I think this is unfortunate, and because to me it's a beverage for the masses. You just look at Western Europe, and I think the proof is that people are literally, wine is part of the meal, it's part of the culture. And I think in this country, we just have so much wine available for sale, and it's probably the most sophisticated marketplace in the world for wine. But I think what happens, the image of wine is that, one, it's you've seen advertisements for wine on television that I think are appalling. You see, a man being driven home in his black limousine by a chauffeur, and he pulls up to this multi-million-dollar mansion, and he's met by his butler with a glass of wine. That promotes an image of wine as an elitist beverage. And you go into a restaurant, one of the things that I think is atrocious in this country is that the great majority of restaurants, treat wine as a special event beverage. You go into the restaurant, and you look at the wine list, generally it's impossible to get a decent, I'm not talking about a great bottle or a good bottle, I'm talking about a decent bottle of wine that doesn't cost more than your entire meal.
wine is also an investment for some people, because the expensive wines are rare and can go up in value. Do you think that your wine writing, the books and the newsletters, affect the prices of wine?
Well,
for people who are investors?
I mean, I get accused of having a huge effect on the marketplace and that causing prices to go up when I recommend certain wines. But I think that, I mean, I look at it as a sort of a byproduct of credibility that, you know, if I didn't have, you know, if people didn't believe in what I was writing about, they wouldn't obviously be buying the wines that I'd recommend. But I think it's really just the product of supply and demand. There's little of it left, and so the price goes up. I think I don't believe in wine as an investment. I never have. Certainly people have used my Wine Advocate as an investment tool. But I've never condoned it. I believe that if you're going to buy, you know, the fine Bordeaux and Burgundies and vintage Port, I guess the three types of wines that are often looked at as investment-grade wines, you should be prepared to drink your investment. I mean, I think the thing about buying, let's take, for example, Bordeaux or vintage Port early before it's mature or ready to drink, is that you can buy it at a much lower price. People have looked at this, and certainly they've said, gee, you can invest in wine and you can resell. Certainly in certain countries like the United Kingdom, they have actually tax schemes that have encouraged investment in wine. But I think it's a very dangerous game. And I think people, you can look for every person who's made a lot of money investing in wine. There are probably five or six people who have been stuck with wine that they bought thinking it was a good investment. And now they're faced with the fact of losing money on it or drinking it, and they probably didn't buy it to drink.
Do you invest in wine?
No, never have and never will.
Is there a wine drinking experience that stands out in your mind as just the best you've ever had?
Well, I've had a lot of awfully good ones. I think the only thing I say about wine drinking experiences, the best one are sharing really good bottles of wine with a lot of friends. I've never known someone who loved wine who wanted to drink it by himself or herself. And I think this is one of the great social benefits of wine drinking that probably gets overlooked. But I think great wine with some of your best friends and with some good food on the table is really, I mean, I can't really ask for anything more in life.
Well, Robert Parker, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it's been my pleasure.
Robert Parker publishes his newsletter, The Wine Advocate, from his home in Parkton, Maryland. He spoke to us from NPR station WJHU in Baltimore. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Let's check in with co-host Renee Montaigne and see what they have planned. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What story is he following?
Well, we have a report tonight from northern Nicaragua, where residents live under constant fear of attack. Just in the last month, 28 civilians have died, and the belief is at the hands of Contra rebels. Also last week, two American journalists narrowly escaped death when rebels ambushed their vehicle. Also, a report from South Africa. The government there today outlawed political activity by 18 black opposition groups. And in Chicago, a 21-year-old white man convicted of aggravated assault for chasing two black men with a baseball bat and shouting racial slurs has been sentenced to spend time in the black community.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Recently, language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg shared some of his thoughts on sexism in language. Today, he continues that discussion and goes beyond the usual examples.
Let me tell you about my friend Teresa. Teresa is a European woman with a smooth, cosmopolitan manner and an impeccable sense of style. What I would like to say, in fact, is that Teresa is suave, but when I try to say that, the word sticks in my throat. You can say that a woman is sophisticated, gracious, worldly, or smooth, but it sounds funny to call a woman suave. Of course, it's no great revelation nowadays to say that the English language reflects a number of traditional attitudes toward gender roles. But when feminists and others try to sort out the problems, they tend to talk only about the relative handful of words and expressions that are overtly sexist, using mankind for humanity and so on. Yet all of that merely scratches the surface. There are hundreds of words in the language that are sensitive to gender, and most of them don't wear their sexual preferences on their sleeves. For example, it's natural enough that we should have different words for talking about men and women's physical appearance. Handsome, dashing, and rugged for men. Pretty, beautiful, and lovely for women. Of course, you can stretch these words if you want to say that a man is good-looking in a feminine sort of way, or vice versa. Montgomery Clift was pretty in A Place in the Sun, and Katharine Hepburn was handsome in The African Queen. Still, The words reflect basic differences in our standards of physical beauty. But it's curious that we often use different words to describe the very same physical characteristics, depending on whether we're talking about a man or a woman. A dark-complexioned man is swarthy, for example, but a woman with the same complexion is more likely dusky. Both men and women can be plump or stout, but only men are called husky or portly. A woman of the same proportions is full-figured or Juno-esque. And when a man gets old and silly, he's called a geezer or a gaffer. A woman has to be content with being a biddy. By the same token, it makes sense that we should have different words to describe the sexual behavior of women and men. A lascivious man is lecherous, a lascivious woman is wanton. But why should we also have different words for behavior that doesn't seem particularly connected to sexuality? Why can only men be suave, oafish, and debonair, while only women can be demure, prim, or pert? Interestingly, the dictionary isn't much help here. The American Heritage Dictionary defines oaf merely as a big, clumsy, thick-headed person. Yet a big, clumsy, thick-headed woman isn't usually called an oaf. I don't know what word you would use. The dictionary defines demure as modest and reserved in manner, but you can't use the word to describe a man who fits that description. Why do we have these different words for men and women? Because gender creates different norms and expectations. Take saucy. The OED defines saucy as impertinent or cheeky and adds that the term is usually affectionate. But in recent times, saucy is only applied to women, usually in historical romances. It's the word that writers like Georgette Heyer and Barbara Cartland routinely apply to their heroines, those saucy little minxes who are always tilting their chins. Can a man tilt his chin? Not in a gothic novel, certainly. A young woman's impertinence can be thought of as charming because it isn't perceived as threatening, or at least not until she steps out of the parlor and into the boardroom. I like to think that we'll manage to get rid of the overtly sexist vocabulary of English someday. But most of these gender-linked vocabulary distinctions run too deep to be eliminated. And besides, who would want to? It's hard to imagine women campaigning for the right to be called oafs or lechers. We may eliminate the inequities, but not the differences. What's saucy for the goose will always be something else for the gander.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow, I'll speak with Tony Huston, son of the late director John Huston, and author of the screenplay for his father's last film, The Dead. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker will review Globe of Frogs by Robin Hitchcock and the Egyptians. The group's enigmatic lyrics and strong pop melodies are a big hit on college radio stations. And film critic Stephen Schiff will review Frantic, starring Harrison Ford and directed by Roman Polanski. So I hope you can join us. We'd like to hear from you. Drop us a line if you have the chance. Our address is Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. That's Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.